From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the lame duck session begins in Lansing. We find out what state lawmakers might move on in these final few weeks of the year. Plus, 18 seasons in the NFL, 11 as a Detroit Lion. He's got himself a Super Bowl ring, but Lomas Brown might never have had that football career without help from his school principal.
He called me over to him and he asked me, "Did you sign up for varsity sports?" And I was like, "No, what is varsity sports?"
Michigan singer-songwriter Mae Erlewine out with songs and dance parties for folks who just aren't feeling the holidays.
You know, grief is a nonlinear process. People are dealing with it, and the holidays really bring up a reminder of those things that we might not have or that we lost.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Tony Award-winning musical Fun Home opens tonight in Detroit. We'll talk with the Michigan playwright who helped bring it to life on the stage.
Many people who write about home are people who left that place and can feel that they are made of it and are also sort of maybe pushing against it in some way.
Also, former Lion star Lomas Brown swings by to share some locker room secrets. But first, today is the official start of the lame duck period of the 98th state legislature. A lot of us remember the frenetic pace of lame duck in 2012 when state lawmakers passed something like 300 bills in that holiday season, including right to work and a new emergency manager law to replace the one that voters had just repealed, with an appropriation carefully attached to make sure it could never be repealed again. Let's look at what's on this year's lame duck to-do list as we say hello to Zach Gorchow of Gangwa News Service.
Great to be here. Thank you.
I'm wondering, with the House and Senate maintaining their Republican majorities, is there a slightly more relaxed approach to lame duck this year or not?
Well, you're not going to see the all-out craziness that you would have seen had the Democrats won control of the House. But there are probably between 24 to 36 major bill packages that have had work done on them in the prior, 20 months that are going to come to fruition now. And there's going to be a lot of activity, maybe not, DEFCON 1, but it's going to be a lot of activity.
Now, you've got some kind of breaking news today we're going to start out with happening in the Senate regarding economic tax development. What's going on?
Well, that's right. You know, for basically 5-6 years, the operating philosophy of the Snyder administration has been to not use tax incentives. We've gotten rid of almost all of them in favor of a lower overall tax climate. Well, legislation that is expected to see a vote on the Senate floor today, kind of out of nowhere, with the governor's blessing, would allow a certain number of businesses each year to receive a substantial tax incentive for creating new jobs. So basically, if a business were to create at least 500 new jobs, it could apply to the state and get to keep all of the income tax revenues it would otherwise withhold from employees' paychecks. And instead of sending that to the state, they'd get to keep it. The total amount in any at any given point that could be abated is $250 million. That's a big chunk of money, and this is a big break in philosophy if it actually becomes law. And right now it looks like it's on the fast track.
And something else that's been kind of circling around and certainly on the agenda for lame duck, brownfield development incentives. Tell us what's happening. This is something that I know the likes of Dan Gilbert would very much like to see.
Right. You have a number of communities, downtown areas, that feel like they need more economic development tools, per se, to start large projects, Dan Gilbert among them. This legislation would allow these developers to keep a certain percentage of tax revenues that would otherwise go to something called downtown development authorities. Many communities have what's called a downtown development authority, and those entities capture taxes that would otherwise go for other purposes to use in the downtowns, perhaps for beautification, perhaps for major projects. The new Red Wings and Pistons Arena in Detroit is largely a creation of the Downtown Development Authority there. So this would create a pretty substantial revenue stream for what are called these large catalytic projects. The governor's office, they're noncommittal on this one so far, but we expect changes, and there's likely to be a vote in the Senate today, at least this week.
Now, a lot of observers are putting their money on energy as being very up there at the top of the must-do list between now and December 15th. What are your thoughts?
It looks like it's going to happen. you know, basically, as long as the Democrats in the House, that's where the bill is now, it's passed the Senate, are on board with increasing the state's mandate for renewable fuels to supply 15% of energy for each utility, as long as they feel like increasing it from 10% to 15% is sufficient, it looks like the votes will be there, that they'll be able to use those Democratic votes combined with perhaps half of the Republican caucus to get the bill done. You still have a large number of Republicans who do not like this bill. They see it as damaging to choice for customers among utilities. But it looks like the utilities have made enough of a case that they need the various provisions this legislation would do to allow them to create new power plants. And then the Democrats, if they can get what they want on the environment, it looks like it'll happen.
And when we consider that we haven't had our policy, energy policy, updated since 2008, I guess we can see why it made it through the Senate. But as you're saying, you're kind of watching in the House in those Democratic votes?
Well, yes. I mean, the Democrats could always try to hold out for more. The risk is, and this is why I think it happens this time, is this is their best chance for a deal. The next House of Representatives that comes in is even more free market oriented. You may have a new, you will definitely have a chair of the Energy Committee who is nowhere near as big an ally of the utilities as Eric Nesbitt is now. He's carrying the freight on this legislation there. There's a lot of fear among the utilities that Gary Glenn, the very conservative representative from Midland, who is a huge proponent of customer choice, would become the next chair of the Energy Committee. The utilities want no part of expanded choice. So there's a lot of time pressure on the utilities to get this done now.
If you just joined me, we're talking to Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News Services. We kind of look at what's on the to-do list in lame duck. Today is the official start of lame duck in Lansing. There's a lot of movement in the legislature, Zach, toward changing the retirement system for teachers in Michigan. So tell us about the overhaul the Republicans are pushing.
Well, there's not a lot of detail yet, but in broad summation, the Senate Republicans would like to end the hybrid pension system that new teachers participate in. So right now, if you're newly hired as a teacher, you get some pension benefit and you get some 401k benefit. That's been in place for 6, 7, 8 years now. They would like to see the partial pension benefit go away and instead be fully 401k. This wouldn't affect what current teachers get, but it would affect new teachers. They feel like, the Republicans feel like this would address the unfunded liability issues in the system and so forth. But the Democrats and others are preparing a big fight on this. And the governor is, sometimes he won't commit to something until it's on his desk, but he's made it pretty clear. He likes the existing system, and the concern his administration has voiced for years is that by going to a full 401k system, there would be a big upfront cost. The proponents of this legislation say that's simply not true. It doesn't look like they're ever going to agree on the numbers. We'll just have to see what happens. Then you've also got a potential big push on municipal employee retirement reform, perhaps most notably on the healthcare piece, healthcare for retired municipal employees. No one really knows exactly where that's headed, and everybody's being really mealy-mouthed, the House Republicans, the Senate Republicans, and the governor, about whether anything's going to happen. But it's one of those things around Lansing right now where everybody's talking about it, that it could happen. There may just not be enough time. If I had to guess, I think this will be more of a 2017 project, simply because they're at a standing start right now. But we will see.
There's a huge number of criminal justice bills kind of circling around, ready to land. Give us a rundown of some of the main ones.
Well, probably the biggest one is the presumptive parole legislation, so-called presumptive parole legislation, which basically says an inmate that reaches his or her minimum release date, in other words, you're sentenced to 20 to 30 years in prison, you hit that 20 years, that as long as the Department of Corrections staff judges you as having a high likelihood of succeeding upon release, that you will be released. You know, no more keeping you in until you're, 28, 30 years just because. So that is passed the House a long time ago. It's been sitting in the Senate. It's unclear what's going to happen there. You've got a bill that would say 17-year-olds can no longer be charged as adults. Basically, you got to be 18 to be charged as an adult.
Which is the case in so many states.
Right, right? You've got other legislation that would provide for a parole mechanism for medically frail prisoners. There's a lot of concern about the high medical cost to the state of dealing with people who've been sentenced to life in prison but are now 85, 90, 95 years old and have huge medical bills. And that's just a slice of it. There's a lot of big stuff there. Most of the key bills are pending on the Senate side. Unclear how that's going to turn out.
One of the bills that has cleared the Senate and is now before the House is Senate Bill 638 that really changes the way political donations can be made in Michigan. And isn't this bill cut from the same cloth as Citizens United, which a Bloomberg poll from a year ago found 78% of Americans hate that Supreme Court decision that opened the political spending tap?
Yeah, in essence, this is designed to codify the Citizens United ruling for state elections. So the Citizens United ruling that made clear that money is speech and authorized the super political action committees and really took most limits off of independent involvement in elections would be put into statute here. It really wouldn't change the way things have operated. But if you were to have down the road a U.S. Supreme Court decision that overturned Citizens United, you would then have Michigan law in place, ensuring that the provisions of Citizen United would continue on in the state of Michigan.
Marking day one of lame duck in 2016, as we talk to Zach Gorchow of Gangwon News Service. Zach, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Tony Award-winning musical Fun Home opens tonight at Detroit's Fisher Theater for a two-week run. Fun Home was adapted from Alison Bechdel's graphic novel telling the story of her relationship with her gay dad and about coming to terms with her own identity as a lesbian. The musical got a very, very warm welcome when it finally got to Broadway, nominated for 12 Tony Awards and winning 5. One of those Tonys went to Michigan native Lisa Krohn. She grew up in Lansing. She's a playwright, actor, and co-founder of the theater group 5 Lesbian Brothers. Lisa Krohn, welcome.
Hi.
How does it feel bringing Fun Home back home to Michigan?
Well, it's very exciting. The Fisher Theater is where I saw my first professional show when I was, I was a young teenager, I think.
Home is a big, big theme in your work, and either with your more autobiographical plays like 2.5 Minute Ride or Well, and of course in Fun Home. What does it take to write about home well?
Well, I think it's been a central subject for many, many writers. It's everything. It is, it is our home. I think many people who write about home are people who left that place and can feel that they are made of it and are also sort of maybe pushing against it in some way. There's something about being from that place and yet, I think for many people, not quite fitting into that place, feeling that ultimately they're going to belong somewhere else, that is the thing that drives people to write about the place they come from.
And it certainly does take that often getting away to be able to look back from a period of distance, whether it is time or actual miles.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in the west side of Lansing. Tell us what was special about your neighborhood.
We moved to the west side of Lansing in the early 60s. The neighborhood at that time was in a period of transition. The real estate industry was actively blockbusting in that neighborhood, and the city had begun to respond accordingly, as happened to so many neighborhoods in that time, by withdrawing social services, selling off parks, closing hospitals and schools. And my mother had gone to Antioch College and really had her conception of the world opened up when she went to live with her college roommate in segregated Baltimore. And seeing the world from inside of that perspective really changed, it really set the course of my mom's life. And my father also, as I write about in 2.5 Minute Ride, was a German-Jewish Holocaust refugee. I think that my parents were quite different from each other, but what they shared was the notion that there was value in the perspective of an outsider, that living with people unlike yourself was valuable and would make you a more interesting, empathetic, and engaged human being. And so my mother wanted us to be raised in a racially integrated neighborhood. And so she, with some other people, founded an organization to stop that tide of towards segregation that was happening in the West Side. And she ran the organization for 7 years. It, actually, that organization continues on to this day, and it created this very stable, racially integrated neighborhood, which remains that today.
That's a real legacy. With Fun Home, you were working with someone else's story, with Alison Bechdel, a 2014 MacArthur Genius Grant winner. How was it adapting someone else's story of home rather than doing what you've done so well, writing out of your own experience?
Well, in one sense, Alison and I have many similarities in that we're the same age. Jeanine Tesori is also, we're all three exactly the same age. Jeanine was the composer of Fun Home. And, you know, I, like Alison, went to a small Midwestern college. Alison went to Oberlin. I went to Kalamazoo College. So, and also, we both were working sort of in lesbian culture through the 80s and 90s, Alison as a graphic, as a cartoonist, and me making theater. So we had that sort of similarity of biography. Other things about us were very, very different, but I think that when I read Fun Home, which, if you know, for anyone who hasn't read Alison's graphic novel, I highly recommend it. It's the kind of book that people read and then they buy it for everybody that they know. But I think that for me, she was asking questions about her relationship with her father and the kind of narratives that her father had about his life and that she had about her father's life, and she was interrogating those narratives. She didn't trust those narratives, and that was, and there was an essayistic quality to that work that I think matched, I felt matched what I had been doing in 2.5 Minute Ride, where I had been doing a similar thing, looking for the difference between things that happen and the stories we tell about those things. Beyond that, I had been taking those questions about those narratives of lived experience and figuring out how to make them dramatic. I felt like I could see the core of what Alison was doing, which when you read the book, it feels like it's a sort of forward-moving narrative about her father's life and her life. But actually, it's a kind of a circular questioning of the woman who's writing the book about her understanding of her relationship with her father. I knew that that was the center. I had some ideas about how to dramatize it.
Well, those ideas worked awfully well when we think of that night, the Tony night. I want us to take a listen to part of your acceptance speech the night you won your Tony Award. You were talking about everything that had been happening on Broadway with innovative and diverse and challenging shows.
We all live in this big house, and we've all been sitting in the same one or two main rooms and thinking that this was the whole house. And this season, some lights got turned on in some other rooms. And we're all like, oh my God, this house is so much bigger than I thought. We're like, I didn't know that we had a garden. I didn't know we had a freaking ballroom. This pantry is full of food. I had no idea. The thing is, all those other rooms have always been there, and there have always been really interesting people in them doing ravishing things. And wouldn't it be so great if after this season, we didn't all just go back into the living room? This has been the most successful season in Broadway history because all of us have been going into all of these amazing rooms in our house where we live together that we haven't been in before. You guys, our house is so big. Please, let's not just all go back into the living room.
Lisa Krohn, what do you think the arts, and theater in particular, can do in coming years to keep making the house bigger?
Boy, I haven't listened to it. I was like, oh, that's a pretty good speech. I haven't listened to it in a long time, maybe since I said it. I think that I am in the process, as are other artists, as we have been for a while, but I think this call is more urgent, to call on our institutions to make sure that there are diverse voices on our stages. This has been a long struggle, and in the past couple of years has gotten moderately better. But what has happened for many, many decades is that there's a blip toward, you know, more gender parity and more racial and ethnic diversity, and then it falls back down to what it has been. And the numbers have been scandalously low over and over and over again, forever, actually. And I think what I was trying to get at in that speech is that, you know, there's a notion that all the good work is making it to the main stages, and that's just not true. That's just not true. My life was changed when I saw the Split Bridges Company on a tiny stage in the East Village. I think that we have just been through an election
where we have seen the danger of believing that the only real people are white men, and white men in particular with money and power. There's a thing that I said many times, but when Fun Home happened at the Public, I had this, so many people came up to me and said, and they meant this as a compliment, they said, this show is they said it's universal, you know, it's so much bigger than just a story about a lesbian. And I would say this show is exactly the size of a story about a lesbian. What just changed is your idea. You just all of a sudden realize that lesbians can be as fully human as any other protagonist. They can be as fully prismatic as any other, you know, as Willie Loman, as Hamlet, as, you know, any other male protagonist. All kinds of people can look at those characters and see themselves in those characters. The same is true for all different kinds of people. And more than ever in this country, the theater has a responsibility to demonstrate over and over and over again the full prismatic humanity of people who are not white men.
Lisa Krohn, her show Funhouse, the award-winning musical, opens tonight for a two-week run at Detroit's Fisher Theater. Lisa Krohn, thank you for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's holiday music for people who maybe aren't really feeling it through the holidays.
It's getting late. It's about that time. We all turn in and say goodnight. Wait a minute.
That's Michigan singer-songwriter Mae Erlewine out with her new EP, The Little Things, and getting ready to hold a series of winter dance parties all around the state. Mae, it's great to see you back here on Stateside. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What a perfectly on-point concept, the idea of holiday music that works for everyone, but especially good for people who maybe are going through some stuff and maybe not feeling all the tidings of comfort and joy of traditional holiday tunes. How'd you come on this idea?
Well, the songs came from a lot of conversations I've had over the years with people who've had, you know, loss during the holidays or are grieving something and sort of struggling to live up to the expectation of this merry and bright and jovial time. And then ending up feeling isolated because of that instead of feeling sort of included and wrapped in this warmth of the holiday. So I kind of wanted to make a little space for that because, you know, grief is a nonlinear process and people are dealing with it. And the holidays really bring up a reminder of those things that we might not have or that we lost. So I wanted to create a little space for that. But I thought if I'm going to do that, it might be good to take the pressure off a little bit by making it sort of danceable or groovy. So that's sort of the concept. It all came in one piece. And I said, okay, I'm going to go with this and see where it takes me.
Well, I think really right now, when you think that a lot of this country is feeling pretty bruised, pretty upset, fearful following the campaign and following the election. So this really is a pretty perfect time for this kind of concept.
Yeah, I mean, I did not anticipate the results of the election to be what they were. So it definitely has more weight now. And I definitely want to create an intentional space for everyone sort of come as you are and to feel their community around them and their support around them and to remind everybody that we don't have to be isolated in our grief or disappointment or fear and that we actually do have a community here and we can kind of see how we can set that up to better serve people that really need that support right now. So the shows are going to be fun, but also intentional space and safe space for people. So
very important. And certainly, as you indicated, when it's holiday time and you have this commercial image of everybody's happy with this. And then I understand you've kind of had a challenging year or so.
Yeah, I've gone through a lot of life transitions in the past few years. And in 2012, I actually lost one of my dearest friends, and his birthday, his 30th birthday, was right around the holidays.
We talked about that when you were here. I remember that because that was part of the process when you were writing one of your last album. And I do remember us talking about that right at the holidays.
Yeah, so it changed them forever for me in some ways. So, yeah, there's definitely been a lot of transitions in my personal life, too, and you know, it definitely has played into this kind of concept and realizing that my own kind of world of grief and sadness needs some space, too. So it's in there, you know. And the songs aren't totally directly, I don't feel like they're about me personally, but it's sort of a collaboration of all these stories I've heard from different people over the years, and including my own self. So,
well, I know there's a lot of people listening who care very much about you. Do you want to share any of what's been going on with you?
I think I'll stick to the music for this, if that's all right.
That's sure. Sure, sure. You know, people care a lot about you. You know that.
Oh, well, I feel that support big time, and I'm grateful for it. And things are good, you know, as they can.
Okay. And you know, I do hear some very reflective lyrics and tunes. We started with the song In a Year, but you do switch to a much happier groove, too. Let's take a listen to some of Come On In. I love that description that you give, that these are kind of songs to groove your soul. Like, really, let's shake yourself off and dance. And there is something marvelous, and it doesn't happen enough, about being with people. You may not know who they are, but if you're on a dance floor, it just fizzes up your soul.
Yeah, I mean, singing and dancing are so good for your brain and your body. And I think a lot of times people might dance, but they're not so sure if they're going to be the one person. So I thought if I labeled them as dance parties, that the people who have hesitation might show up ready to just dance it out and feel the music. Music is so helpful to me when I'm sad or feeling anything. It just kind of takes it to another level. So I want to encourage people to just be in the music and be together and feel it.
You got a bunch of musicians accompanying you.
I've got a really wonderful band for these shows. I'm just singing. This is the first tour I've ever done where I'm not playing an instrument. So that's new and fun. And so I've got two guitar players, Eric Kuhn and Phil Berry, and then Joe Wilson subbing for Eric for one of the shows. Terrence Massey is going to play trumpet. Max Lockwood on bass, Michael Schumann on drums, Mike Lynch on keys. So it's a big band, and then we're going to definitely have some special guests along the way. So it'll be musically a lot of fun.
You can get all of the details about the new EP, The Little Things, and that whole schedule for the winter dance parties by going to May's website, mayerlewine.com. And I know you've brought your guitar with you. What are you going to play us out with?
I'm going to play the slowest song on the EP, and this is a song that's sort of about feeling like being alone and processing things. So it's called While the World.
I just want to take it slow. Turn up the tremolo and try to keep both feet on the ground while the whole world keeps turning round. I'm not going out on the town tonight, gonna turn down the light like nobody's home. Nothing's gonna make this feel alright. I'm not gonna try. I'm letting go. I just wanna sit and think, turn up the intensity, and do my best to live with the sound. While the world, while the whole world keeps turning around.
May Earlywine singing from her new EP, The Little Things. It's out December 1st. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. From a band kid growing up in Florida to a fearsome offensive tackle who played 18 seasons in the NFL, including 11 years as a Detroit Lion, Lomas Brown has quite a story to tell. He was named to the Pro Bowl for 7 straight seasons, and he got that Super Bowl ring when he was with Tampa Bay. Lomas first came to Michigan when he was drafted by the Lions. That was in 1985. And he's still here, despite the snow and the cold winters. His new memoir, co-authored with Mike Eisenberg, is titled If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Detroit Lions Sideline, Locker Room, and Press Box. And he is here with us now. Lomas, I want to start at your very beginning. Who pointed you to football?
Well, you know, it was my principal. It was a principal. He's not here with us any longer. His name was Alex Bromier. And a funny story. What happened was the first day of school, I went in and signed up for classes. I'm coming out the auditorium. Someone says, hey, I turn around and it's the principal. I didn't know that at the moment, but he called me over to him and he asked me, did you sign up for varsity sports? And I was like, no, what is varsity sports? So he just grabbed me by the arm and took me back in there and he signed me up for it. So I had to wait till the end of the day. It was the last class. And come to find out it was football that he signed me up for. So I'm like, wow. It was just him. It was his. He was the reason why I started football. And
amazing.
I thank that man every time I would see him. Because if not for him, I know no telling where I would have been at.
You know what? What a real testament to the power of the right word from the right teacher at the right time.
That's right.
Something else. So we're going to roll ahead a few years. You discover you'd been drafted by Detroit. What'd you know about Detroit? What were your thoughts?
You know, nothing. I knew it was cold. I knew y'all made automobiles up here. And at that part, at that time, I hate to say it was like the Myrtle Capital, you know.
80s were rough.
Yeah, it was rough up here. So I didn't have any idea what I was stepping into. But I knew, you know, it was a team that had only won 4 games the year before. So the team wasn't doing well. So it just seemed like, you know, it was going to be a challenge, and especially for me growing up down south my whole life, you know, having to get acclimated to the climate up here. You know, just everything was so different up here. Everything moved faster up here. You know, I was down in Miami, you know, you had it was a mixing bowl. So it was just so different from my upbringing, how I was brought up. But I was happy that I got the contrast because I got to see how the Midwest mm-hmm. live, and I loved it. I loved it, and I still love it today.
And you're still here
today.
That's
right.
Your book has so many inside stories and views of people you've encountered while you were aligned. So let's do a pop quiz and get your quick views on some of these folks.
Mm-hmm.
Barry Sanders.
Okay, everybody say I'm biased. The best running back I've ever seen play and the best running back that I've ever played with, and just the best person, just humble. You know, I blocked for Barry for 7 of his 10 years and never once. And, you know, Barry took a lot of losses and everything. He took a lot of losses. I never once heard him get up, point his fingers, or say anything bad to the players or to an offensive lineman. And that's a testimony to him because I've been around running backs. I've been around people that have really not been good people. But him, he's just been an excellent person. And that's why we would do any and everything we could to make sure that guy succeeded because he was just that type of person.
Were you surprised when he walked away?
I wasn't surprised when he walked away. I really wasn't. I think a lot of people thought he was coming back. I knew he wasn't going to come back because I knew how Barry was. Barry's a person of his conviction. Barry, once he walks away, once he set his mind to something, that's it. He's not going to come back. I knew he wasn't coming back. I knew the game of football had played this path with him. And I'm going to tell you one thing, Cindy, that really was telling to me is when I went to his Hall of Fame mm-hmm. induction. And he said there at this Hall of Fame, he said, I didn't choose football. Football chose me. And for this guy to give 10 years, 10 of the best years that the Lions fans have probably ever seen out of one player and do that and really, you know, he didn't choose football. You know, football chose him, but to play at that level, that gave me so much more respect for him to put his body in harm's way for 10 years. And he was able to walk away on top, and that's what I'm happy about for Barry.
Someone who has has been in this studio through his work at the U of M Anti-Depression Center.
That's
Eric
right.
Hipple.
Yes.
What do you want to say about Eric
Hipple? You
know, Hipple?
That, and another great guy. I came in. He was already here. Mm-hmm. And it was funny. At that time in 1985, $500,000 was a lot. And that's what Eric was making. And we used to walk by his locker, me and Kevin Glover, and used to look at his locker and be like, wow, this guy makes $500,000. It was just such a big number to us yeah. back in the day. And now, compared to now, that's just a drop in the hat. But another guy that went through a lot, persevered. That's that. When I think about Eric, perseverance is the word that really comes to mind with him. With all the stuff he went through with it, losing his son, mm-hmm. which is something I just couldn't imagine, losing a child. But losing his son, then what he went through.
With his own depression battle.
Depression, yeah. And you know how he's come through it. And now he's the kind of the guiding light to help other guys, not just in the league, but guys in the Army, in our armed services.
Students.
Students. And he's touching people all over, not just in the state of Michigan. And I couldn't have been proud of Eric for how things have really turned around for him.
Scott Mitchell.
You know what, Cindy, you know, with me and Scott, we've talked maybe twice since everything with the ESPN thing and everything. And we've talked. And the thing I say about Scott, you know what I would say with him? I would say, use the word victim with him. And the reason why I would use the word victim with him is because we were a locker room. If you think about it, in 1991, we had got to the championship game. One game from the Super Bowl, getting there. You know, we had a lot of tragedies and injuries that kind of hurt the team the following years, that kind of had us going up and down. When they brought Scott in, they dropped Scott in the locker room full of guys ready to win. I don't think the organization equipped Scott the right way to come in there, meaning I don't think they told Scott the type of locker room he was coming into, the type of environment he was coming to, where he was coming into a locker room full of hungry guys. We were hungry. We were ready to win. We were on the cusp.
Fans were hungry.
Absolutely. Yeah. They've been hungry. We were looking at the Dallas Cowboys, and if you think about it, we had beat them in 91, beat them down, and our team was similar to their team. The only thing we needed was a quarterback. They had the great receiver. We had Herman Moore. We had Barry Sanders. They had Emmitt Smith. They had Troy Aikman. We needed our Troy Aikman to get us over the hump. And I think when they brought Scott in, they didn't let him know how it was, how hungry we were, how ready this team was. And I just don't think his attitude, I just don't think his hunger and desire was the same as ours in that locker room. And that was a complete conflict. Mm-hmm. That conflicted us. And anytime you're a leader, the leader of your team isn't on the same page with the rest of the guys, it's not going to work. And you know, we had a couple of good years with Scott, but I just think things could have been a lot better. And when I talked to Scott years later, he told me he was going through a lot of personal things, which we didn't know. And again, if he'd have known the type of locker room he was in, he would have known that he could have came to us guys and told us, because everybody was going through stuff. I went through a divorce while I was with the Lions. Everybody goes through things, but that's what your teammates are there for, to hold you up, to help you go through those tough times. But your teammates have to know. And I just think, you know, through him not knowing us, through us not knowing him, that just never worked out that way.
There are a lot of insights, and it's interesting that he is one of the folks who does contribute to your book with some
yes.
quotes, so that's worth it. You were right there the day Mike Utley suffered that hit that left him paralyzed. What
yes.
do you remember about that moment?
You know what? The thing I remember the most is, and I was hurt, Cindy, so I had hurt my shoulder. I think I got hurt the game before against Tampa Bay, so I was on the sideline. And when Mike went down, you know, he was down for a while. And I just remember, you know, us just standing on the sideline, you know, just watching. But then it started taking a little longer than normal. And I didn't really get tipped off until I seen Kevin Glover walking off the field. And it looked like he was crying. And when I seen that, that's when it really hit me that something was really, really wrong with Mike. And then, of course, you know, them putting him on the stretcher. Yeah. And then, of course, the iconic him giving us the thumbs up going off the field. It was just so, you know, football brings you a lot of things. And, you know, of course, losing is one of the things, and you never like to lose a game. But when you lose a teammate, when you lose a brother, when you lose a friend, you know, like that, and lose him the way we lost Mike, you know, it still resonates to this day.
He's
one of my best friends. I talk to him frequently. Matter of fact, he was just up here 2 weeks ago. Me, him, his wife, and my wife went to have lunch along with Tim Pendel and some other people. And it was just great seeing him. And know what, Cindy? He still says he's going to walk. He said that the day we went to visit him in the hospital room after his accident. And here it is, I don't know how many years, 20-some-odd years later, he still said he's going to walk. And that's the type of person he is.
I'm talking with Lomas Brown about his memoir, If These Walls Could Talk, stories from the Detroit Lions sideline, locker room, and press box. And here we are as we talk. The Lions are in first place in their division. You know better than anybody how the team and their fans have had their ups and downs. What do you think? Could this team do what you and your teammates did in 91 again?
You know what? The sky's the limit. All the opportunities are in front of them. And that's that. Anytime you get an opportunity, you know, I mean, and they have it. They just need to take advantage of it. If you think about it, you know, they beat Minnesota twice this year, so they have the head-to-head against them. They got Green Bay, Chicago. They come here. So you got all the rest of your divisional games pretty much at home. So they have the opportunity, and that's 7-4 right now. If you think about it, if you take care of your home field, which would be, I think it's 2 or 3 more games, that'll put you at 9-10 wins, which should get you in. So they're coming together at the right time. They're getting healthy, which is important because a lot of teams get banged up during this time of the year. It seemed like we're getting all our people back at this time of the year, which is a great time to be healthy. They feel confident about yourself. And I know, you know, because that's how we used to feel. Right.
Exactly. In the head, right?
Exactly right. Because you go out there knowing you're going to win the game. That's important, to go out on the field knowing you're going to win. Now, you don't know how much you're going to win the game, but you don't know how the game is going to go.
And it might be in the last moment.
Like it has been all year long for us.
Yep, come from behind.
They're going out there with the concept that, hey, we know we could beat this team. Now we just got to go out and execute.
Lomas, what is it like when things are going badly and, you know, you go out there and the losing streak is just, it stinks the place up. You have fans sitting there with bags over there.
Yes.
How much does that hit you players?
Oh, it hits. And that's a great question, Cindy, because I don't think how people think it affects the players, but
you care.
Oh, you have to. This is your profession. This is your profession. You have to care. And you think about it, you got guys coming up every year at the college ranks. You got guys from other teams coming in that can take your job. So it's super, super competitive. So when you lose, you should feel it like that. I remember we used to wouldn't go eat. Man, your food didn't taste well. You know, you treated your family a little differently than you would because you're upset about things.
People probably giving you a little lip when you're out. I saw that happen. I can't think who it was at a Starbucks.
Yep.
And I was behind him in line, and people were like, well, thanks a lot.
See? It happens. I mean, it happens. I remember once back in, this probably had to be 93 or so, I had got hurt bad ankle sprain. I missed like 4 weeks. But I was supposed to miss 6 weeks. And I tried to come back earlier and got re-injured in the game. And I remember my wife, she was in the stands, and she was telling me some of the stuff, you know, that was being said, you know, about me, you know, from the fans. But again, you know, you invest so much to fans. They invest so much their hard-earned money and their time. You know, with the players, they invest so much their time and everything, their bodies. And when things don't go right, there's a high level of frustration, not just for the fans, but for the players, the coaches, everybody. Just nothing is right when you're on a losing streak or things don't go well over there. Just nothing is right. So it's all always, they say winning cures all. That's the truth.
You know, after you left the Lions, you played in Arizona, Cleveland, New York, finally Tampa Bay, mm-hmm. Super Bowl 37. What told you it was time to call it a career?
Well, when I was with the Cleveland Browns, I signed a 3-year deal with Cleveland. That was the first team that ever cut me, You know, out of my years, they just said, they just cut me and stuff. And it hurt me. It was probably one of the lowest points, other than losing the Super Bowl, mm-hmm. that I had. And I remember driving back to Detroit, and I remember Jim Fossil from the New York Giants, coach calling me. And he was calling me saying, hey, I want you to come out to New York and come see us and everything. And I'm telling Coach, no. I think I'm going to retire. I was in my 15th year. I'm 30-some years old. I think I'm going to retire. And I remember him telling me, just come. Just come out and see it. Went out and seen it. And that the rest was history. I never turned back. That was the first Super Bowl I had ever got to. If I wouldn't have signed with them, I would have never got to my first Super Bowl, even though I ended up losing it. Yeah. And it's just the same way with Tampa Bay. I was signed with Tampa Bay a day before they went to training camp. Wasn't sure I was going to sign with them, but I remember it was the hottest year. That's when Corey Stringer had died that year, and there was a big thing with hydrating players and watching the temperature. And I remember down in Tampa, it was brutal. Oh, my goodness.
You'd acclimated to this Michigan weather.
Oh, that's right.
Florida
I sure
kid.
Was. And I was older, and it was brutal. And I remember calling my mother and telling her, I think I'm going to retire. I think this is it. You know, I don't know if I should be out here doing this. And she talked me into staying. And I stayed, and I say that to say if I wouldn't have stayed, I would have never got my Super Bowl ring. So when I knew at that point, once I got my Super Bowl ring, it was time for me to go. I had put in my 18 years. I had been blessed to get it in my last year. My body was physically wearing down. The guys were getting bigger and stronger and faster. You know, the game was moving a lot faster. So you kind of know when all these things come into effect, you start knowing that it's coming to an end. And I'm glad I was able to get my ring, because it probably, if it wasn't for that, I probably would have tried to hang on a few more years to try to get it, and then no telling how it would have ended up. So I'm glad I was able to go out on top getting the ring.
And on that high note, Lomas Brown, number 75. His memoir with Mike Eisenberg is titled If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Detroit Lions Sideline, Locker Room, and Press Box. Such a pleasure, Lomas. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Liz Dickey, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.